Hello everyone, and thank you for attending today's Medicaid Value-Based Payment Approaches for Maternal and Infant Health National Learning Webinar. Before we begin, we wanted to cover a few housekeeping items. At the bottom of your audience console are multiple application widgets that you can use. You can expand each widget by clicking on the Maximize icon on the top right of the widget or by dragging the bottom right corner of the widget panel. Additional materials, including a copy of today's slide deck, are available in the Resource List widget indicated by a green file icon at the bottom of your screen. If you have any questions during the webcast, you can click on the purple Q&A widget at the bottom and submit your questions there. We will have Q&A sessions throughout the webinar. If you have any technical difficulties, please click on the yellow Help widget. It has a question mark icon and covers common technical issues. However, you can also submit technical questions through the Q&A widget. Please note, most technical issues can be resolved by pressing F5 or Command plus R on Macs to refresh the player console. At the end of the webinar, you can provide feedback using the survey widget in the widget menu at the bottom of the event console. Finally, an on-demand version of the webcast will be available approximately one day after today's event and can be accessed using the same audience link that you used to access today's webinar. Now I'd like to introduce Crystal Tyler, research leader in the Center for Maternal and Child Health at IBM Watson Health. Crystal, you now have the floor.
Thank you so much and welcome everyone. Next slide, please. The purpose of this webinar is to elaborate on the potential impact of payment reform on maternal and infant health outcomes, describe value-based payment approaches that states can implement to improve maternal and infant health outcomes and care quality indicators, and finally, to provide examples of state Medicaid value-based payment approaches in the maternal and infant health field. Next slide, please. During our webinar, we'll start by introducing today's presenters. Next, we'll provide an overview of the Medicaid Innovation Accelerator Program and VBP webinar series. We will describe the importance of payment reform in the maternal and infant health field, provide an overview of Medicaid VBP approaches in the maternal and infant health field, and finally, end with state perspectives from Louisiana and Arkansas, who have implemented VBP approaches to address maternal and infant health outcomes. To break up the presentation event, we'll have two opportunities for the audience to ask questions. Next slide, please. Today's presentation will include speakers with expertise in maternal and infant health and value-based payment, and in implementing VBP approaches to address maternal and infant health outcomes within a Medicaid setting. First, we'll have Katherine Griffith from the Medicaid Innovation Accelerator Program. I'm Crystal Tyler from IBM's Watson Health. Dr. Mark Smith is also from IBM Watson Health. Next slide, please. We also have representatives from Louisiana and Arkansas. From Louisiana, we have Dr. Pooja Mehta from the Louisiana State University Health Sciences Center and Dr. William Golden from the Arkansas Division of Medical Services. Next slide, please. First up, we have Katherine Griffith from the Medicaid Innovation Accelerator Program. Katherine?
Great, thank you, Crystal. On behalf of the Medicaid Innovation Accelerator Program, I'd like to welcome everybody here. We are so pleased to have people on our last value-based payment webinar in a series we've held over the last month. Before we jump into the exciting stuff, I always like to provide a little background on the Medicaid Innovation Accelerator Program for those who are new to the series. It is a technical support program that is based out of the Centers for Medicaid and CHIP Services, but we partner with the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation. So we provide technical support to state Medicaid programs around their delivery system reform needs around various topics such as maternal and infant health and value-based payment. It is not a grant program. It's purely technical support. So, and what we define as technical support is one-on-one technical assistance and webinars, national webinars such as these. On the next slide, you'll see, as I mentioned, this is the fourth of webinar series we've had around Medicaid value-based payments. And all of the materials from these webinars, if you missed previous ones, will be on the Medicaid Innovation Accelerator Program website within a month of when they aired. So that first one on Medicaid value-based payment approaches will be posted in just a few days because that happened at the beginning of October. So thank you all for joining, and I'll pass it back to Crystal.
Thanks so much, Catherine. So now I'd like to talk a bit about the importance of payment reform in maternal and infant health. Next slide. But before we jump into the presentation, I'd like to get a sense for your familiarity with the topic of today's presentation. Next slide, please. So how would you describe your familiarity with value-based payment? Would you say that you're well-versed in VBP approaches, that you're aware of VBP approaches, but that you don't consider yourself an expert? Would you say that you're new to the term VBP? Or would you say that you participated in one of the previous three Medicaid IAP VBP webinars in October? And you can select all that apply. I'll give you just 30 seconds to respond to the polling question. Okay, can we view the results, please? All right, it looks like 14% of respondents said that they are well-versed in VBP approaches. Nearly 70% said that they're aware of VBP, but they don't consider themselves an expert. And 16% said that they are new to the term VBP. Another 16% said that they participated in one of the previous three webinars. So we've got a few people who participated in previous webinars. All right, thanks everyone for your participation. Moving on to the next slide, please. So adverse outcomes such as preterm birth and low birth weight births disproportionately affect Medicaid beneficiaries. Preterm birth specifically accounts for 1/3 of all infant deaths. Average healthcare utilization costs are much higher for preterm birth compared with uncomplicated deliveries. Consequently, preterm birth is a key cost driver, and it accounts for approximately half of all pregnancy-related costs. In 2017 alone, costs are projected to top $32 billion when adjusted for inflation. Next slide, please. Medicaid is a key source of financing for births among families with low and modest incomes. Although there is variability across states, Medicaid pays for almost half of all births in the United States and a higher proportion of preterm births than private insurers. For the 14 states in dark blue, the darkest color, Medicaid finances between 54 and 72% of all births. A high number of Medicaid-financed births, particularly those that are complicated births, carry potentially avoidable health complications and high costs. Next slide, please. Now I'd like to hand it over to Mark Smith from IBM Watson Health, who will discuss Medicaid VBP approaches in maternal and infant health. Mark?
Thank you, Crystal. Next slide, please. This graphic presents the continuum of alternative payment models, or APMs. It's divided into four broad categories defined by the payment mechanism. Within each category, there are subcategories distinguished by the quality-based mechanism used, such as performance rewards and penalties, gain sharing, and downside risk. There are four broad categories of the APM framework. Category one is fee-for-service, where there is no link of quality and value. In category two, there is fee-for-service, but with a link of quality and value. Examples would be pay-for-reporting programs. In Category 3, the alternative payment models are built on a fee-for-service architecture. These could include APMs with shared savings and APMs with shared savings and downside risk. And finally, Category 4 is population-based payments. Next slide, please. The design elements that go into a value-based payment approach tend to get more complex as you move from the left to the right of the previously shown framework. Here are some of the key elements when you design a value-based payment plan. The patient population of focus. Which services will be part of the value-based payment? Financial performance, measurement, and benchmarking. Likewise, quality performance, measurement, and alignment. How patients will be attributed to providers. Risk adjustment, and how data will be shared across providers and systems. Next slide, please. States have expressed interest in applying value-based payment to the field of maternal and infant health. You will hear examples from Arkansas and Louisiana next. There are several other examples that we won't have time to cover today. They include South Carolina's non-payment policy for early elective deliveries and pay-for-performance for their Nurse Family Partnership Home Visiting Program, Ohio's perinatal bundled payment, and Oregon's implementation of global payments for early prenatal care initiation and postpartum care. Now we'd like to open it up for questions. Remember to use the Q&A widget.
All right, it looks like we don't have questions for you yet, Mark. So how about we move on to the next phase of the presentation?
Right.
All right, thank you so much, Mark. For this next phase of the presentation, we'll include state perspectives from Louisiana and Arkansas on the implementation of VBP approaches within the maternal and health field. Next slide, please. Our first presenter is from Louisiana, and it's Dr. Pooja Mehta. Dr. Mehta serves as the Maternal and Women's Health Policy Director at the Consortium for Health Transformation at the Louisiana State University Health Sciences Center School of Public Health. Dr. Mehta.
Thank you. Thank you so much for this opportunity to share our experience with our pay-for-performance initiative around progesterone initiation for preterm birth prevention. As Crystal mentioned, I'm the Maternal and Women's Health Policy Director for the Louisiana Department of Health, and I'll be summarizing some recent years of work under various leadership in Louisiana. Our commitment to value-based payment in the state comes from our commitment to the Triple Aim, which you're all familiar with. That is to improve the patient experience of care, including quality and satisfaction, to improve the health of populations, and to reduce the per capita cost of healthcare. On our next slide, thank you. As you've already heard today, value-based payment is a specific means to the end of improving quality and value. In our state, we're pursuing value-based payment as we also address access with our Medicaid expansion and engage with managed care via our current proposed contract extension and planning for our new RFP in 2 years. Embedding value-based payment into our approach to our expansion and our MCO contracting reflects our commitment to broader payment and system reform. Our quality strategy in Louisiana focuses health plans and providers on shared targets for population health improvement using a limited set of stakeholder recommended quality measures. If you know Louisiana, you know Louisianans are very proud of their state and local culture, so it's also not surprising that our quality strategy includes a homegrown measure representing the rate of progesterone initiation in pregnant women with a prior preterm birth, in addition to a selection of NQF and HEDIS measures that were selected through broad stakeholder engagement. Our value-based payment contracting approach attempts to align financial incentives for plans and providers, and our current approach is to add a 2% withhold of the monthly capitation rate for not complying with monitoring of key measures or achievement of quality targets in incentivized measures, putting real money on the table, and this comes out to about $140 million a year, equal to the profit margin that's built into our rate setting. We're planning to transition from this slightly more punitive approach that centers around contract compliance to a future incentive to earn back for high MCO performance on quality measures. You can move on to the next slide. So just to give a bit more background, given the focus of today's webinar, I'm going to delve into this evolving approach to value-based payment a little bit more. Thinking about our current strategy, we feature a 1% withhold for quality and health outcome improvement. This current $250,000 penalty was really the only contract lever to influence plan behavior on quality. We first focused on incentivizing plans to monitor certain quality measures and then phased into incentivizing achieving defined targets for a subset of those measures. We hope that this will evolve into not simply withholding a specified penalty, but also giving plans a chance to earn back the withhold if they attain specific targets or stretch goal targets over time. Going forward, we would also like to move from a small penalty for not performing to expectation to a larger reward for behaving as expected. So to add withhold earn back for development and submission of a strategic plan to increase alternative payment model use over time. We hope to add the withhold earn back for meeting implementation milestones in each MCO strategic plan in calendar year 18 and 19. Next slide. So that provides some overall context on our approach to value-based payment. In terms of the selection of specific quality measures, there are 9 incentivized measures in the current contract, and we revised our quality strategy for our proposed contract extension with broad input from external stakeholders through regional town hall meetings, Medicaid medical advisory meetings, which in our state are called our quality committee and our subcommittees in the state, industry-specific meetings, and also soliciting for public comment. Next slide. In our proposed contract extension, there are 17 incentivized measures, including one homegrown measure that I've already mentioned that captures the initiation of injectable progesterone, or 17P, for prevention of a recurrent preterm birth in women who've experienced a prior preterm birth. So why add this homegrown measure to our overall quality strategy? Next slide. As Crystal started to speak about, we know that more than half of infant mortality occurs in babies born before 32 weeks. We also know that Louisiana ranks among the worst in the nation for preterm birth outcomes and infant mortality. And what you see on the right of this slide is that our state preterm birth rate based on vital records is hovering at around 13% and is essentially a flat line for the last 10 years. And this flat line also conceals dramatic racial and ethnic and geographic disparities in preterm birth. 17P or progesterone is an injectable medication that's been shown to decrease the risk of a recurrent preterm birth in women who've experienced a prior spontaneous preterm birth. And we see this 33% risk reduction when progesterone is administered on a weekly basis between 16 and 36 weeks gestational age. It's one of only a few truly evidence-based interventions for the prevention of preterm birth, but as you can imagine, there are some major challenges in implementing this intervention given the nuances of who's eligible and how to get someone a medication on a weekly basis over the course of a pregnancy. Next slide. So here's a timeline of that implementation journey filled with challenges, but also with a stream of passionate champions who paved the path along the way, including Dr. Rebecca Gee, our current Secretary of Health, and Dr. Cui, our former Medicaid Medical Director. In 2011, the Louisiana Birth Outcomes Initiative kicked off, creating a precedent for collaboration between hospitals on birth outcomes and also creating a scaffolding for the introduction of other forms of payment reform, for example, non-payment for early elective deliveries before 39 weeks. In 2014, Medicaid partnered with Lamico, a local insurer, to expand provider education on progesterone initiation, as well as partnerships with the Louisiana Hospital Association, hospitals in our most impacted regions, and partnership between the Office of Public Health and Vital Records. Our Vital Records collaboration enabled the creation of a high-risk pregnancy registry available to our MCO so they can correctly identify beneficiaries who've experienced a prior preterm birth at the time that they become pregnant again. We also partnered with Optum to cover home administration of the progesterone injection to overcome patient-side barriers. In 2015, progesterone initiation became an incentivized quality measure, and we started our path to value-based payment in the MCO Performance Improvement Projects, empowering plans to achieve a 20% initiation rate in eligible patients by the end of calendar year 2017. We also partnered with the March of Dimes and our State Perinatal Commission to explore provider-side barriers to progesterone initiation in order to inform MCO improvement efforts. And currently, we're seeing new opportunities to further our work by making our approach to value-based payment more sophisticated, re-energizing our Medicaid Quality Committee, and launching our State Perinatal Quality Collaborative. Next slide. So breaking out to look at some of those design elements that Mark mentioned, some core components of our value-based payment strategy. Our target population is women who specifically meet the criteria shown on this slide, i.e. those with a singleton prior preterm birth. Next slide. Going into more detail on our identification of this target population using the high-risk pregnancy registry that I've already mentioned, the registry pools vital record information summarizing prior birth data with Medicaid claims data and a provider-generated notice of pregnancy form to provide MCOs with a real-time mechanism to identify eligible candidates for 17P when they initiate prenatal care. So the vital record information on gestational age and plurality from a prior birth is matched with all women and children ever enrolled in Medicaid via a cooperative agreement. The registry is then provided to the Medicaid fiscal intermediary who parses the list out according to plan enrollment and distributes a sub-registry to managed care organizations. And then the provider gives a notice of pregnancy with a screening assessment to plans at the time that the patient initiates prenatal care in order to confirm that plans are able to monitor outcomes and claims in those who are eligible for 17 progesterone initiation. Next slide. So in terms of benchmarking, MCOs report their quality performance to the NCQA and additionally measures are validated by our external quality review organization under our current contract. The external quality review organization works with MCOs on an ongoing basis to confirm that data quality is high, that data matches fee-for-service claims data, and that measures are constructed similarly across plans, which is a real challenge with this homegrown measure. Then our current strategy is that based on the reported MCO's performance measure outcomes, a maximum of $250,000 per measure is withheld if a specified performance measure falls below the established benchmark. And with specifically the initiation of progesterone measure, our established benchmark for our first year is a 20% initiation rate in the target population. Next slide. So to summarize, we have a data share between the Office of Public Health, Vital Statistics, and Medicaid to identify a target population. Primary data from the MCOs is shared via the MCO Performance Improvement Projects and Reviews and reviewed by an external quality review organization and also reported to NCQA. And then we also have global evaluation data that's available for Medicaid fee-for-service claims. So let's talk a little bit about some of this evaluation data in order to look at the impact of our strategy. And I just want to stress that what I'm presenting here is based on fee-for-service claims data and so may vary if compared to plan-specific evaluation data. Looking at the overall impact of our value-based payment approach and heightened attention to this issue, we've seen a fourfold increase in the rate of progesterone initiation for preterm birth prevention over time. So our y-axis here shows the rate of initiation approaching our 20% target, and our x-axis shows each sequential year since we spearheaded this effort. Our progesterone initiation rate in Medicaid in 2016 was about 16%, and we are hoping for a closer to 20% in 2017. So we have much ground gained, and we also have work still to do in terms of achieving population health outcome improvement in this area. I should also note that the denominator includes all women with a prior preterm birth, even if they had an iatrogenic preterm birth. So there are some women in this denominator who don't necessarily are not eligible for progesterone, and we can talk more about the construction of the measure in the Q&A if that's of interest. When we break down some of our data, we can also see that as we implement value-based payment, we're not necessarily addressing disparities by race and ethnicity, despite overall improvements, with Hispanic women significantly less likely than Asian, Black, and White women in 2016 to have had progesterone initiated based on our measure. This points to the need for efforts to prioritize an even implementation as we change Medicaid policy, given existing significant disparities in perinatal outcomes. Next slide. So as always, implementation of our pay-for-performance strategy has exposed barriers along the way that we've tried to address. On this slide, we've split barriers encountered up into the first column, insurance and pricing barriers, the second column, supply chain barriers, and our third column, the purple column, patient and provider level barriers to adherence. We've attempted to address these barriers in a variety of ways. For example, addressing uninsurance through our Medicaid expansion, addressing cost barriers with full coverage of brand name progesterone McKenna, elimination of prior authorizations for progesterone across the MCOs, coverage of the drug as both a medical and pharmacy benefit, creation of an ordering and billing guide, and coverage of home administration of the drug to address community and patient-side barriers, for example, with difficulty adhering to a weekly injection, transportation to a provider office, et cetera. Next slide. So We feel proud of our efforts to date, but as always, much work remains to be done. And in terms of our next steps and future efforts, we do hope to improve communication between providers, patients, and MCOs for more effective barrier analysis and continued improvement cycles in order to improve our initiation rates and ultimately decrease our preterm birth rate in the state. We hope to further align and synergize redundant efforts on improvements, so bringing MCO quality improvement strategy into alignment with provider quality improvement strategy, understanding best practices from other states that have shown changes in outcomes with progesterone initiation and implementation, continuing to shift from monitoring to incentivizing measures, and refining our pay-for-performance approach so we move into kind of further progress towards alternative payment models with an opportunity in the new MCO RFP coming up in 2 years. We hope to move from process evaluation of progesterone initiation to ultimate outcome evaluation of our preterm birth rates and our low birth weight baby rates. And of course, we also hope to further engage with our perinatal quality collaborative in the state to further engage providers and practices in improvement efforts and system transformation. Next slide. Just want to thank our Medicaid Director, Jen Steele, and our data team at Medicaid, Larry Humble and Eddie Myers, our Quality Director, Pia Hansen, for their assistance in providing this data and these slides. And I'm happy to take any questions if we have time right now.
Thank you so much. I have one question for you before Dr. Golden's presentation. And the question is, where can we find a list of the 9 incentive measures in your current contracts?
Our contract is available on the Louisiana Medicaid website in one of the appendices, and I'm happy to send out that link so that people can find it readily as part of this presentation.
Okay.
And then our contract our draft contract extension is also online if you wanted to see the expanded list of measures that are in the proposed contract extension.
All right, and then one more question. This is for you, Dr. Mehta. Roughly how big is your denominator? How many women are eligible for 17P each year? That's the first half of the question.
That is a great question. I don't have access to that number in front of me right now. We have about 60,000 births in the state. I'm doing some quick math. So we're talking in terms of order of magnitude in several thousand births a year. And I apologize that I don't have the exact number right now. The point that I was trying to make is that of that large denominator of all women who are pregnant who have had a prior spontaneous preterm birth, some of those births were perhaps medically indicated or associated with a delivery decision from a provider, and we haven't yet refined this measure that you're seeing presented today to have that more refined denominator, which we estimate about 20-30% of the total births perhaps would not meet criteria for a provider to prescribe progesterone in the current pregnancy.
Okay, thank you for that. And then I'll just ask the second half of this question, and then we'll turn to our next presenter and then have our second question and answer session at the end. So this question asks, if the MCOs or managed care organizations are penalized for not reaching 20%, then do you think you're discouraging them by continuing to penalize them even if they're making improvements?
So I think that is a really great point, and it is definitely a delicate balance between, especially if people are further away from the target in terms of incentivizing continued PDSAs and improvement cycles. And I think that that's really why we want to move out of this more rigid approach to value-based payment into what I would think of as a more evolved stage where we're actually rewarding improvements or achievement of stretch targets. I think that this strategy, going back to sort of the categories that Mark was outlining before, this is a kind of an early category 2 stage strategy, and we hope to kind of move further along the spectrum into a category 3. and along the way, we would prefer to reward MCOs for improvement efforts rather than this kind of all or nothing withhold that is actually for a pretty finite sum of money. Because you're right, it doesn't necessarily incentivize continued PDSAs and commitments to improvement depending on where a plan is starting. So I think that's a really great point. And we're continuing to work in our performance improvement projects to sort of continue that spirit of coaching and collaboration to keep that at the core of our strategy, with the financial penalty as a wrap on the knuckles that comes along with a more profound sort of culture change about how to achieve forward progress.
Thank you so much. All right, so next slide, please. Our next presenter is Dr. William Golden. Dr. Golden is a professor of medicine and public health at the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences. He's also the medical director of Arkansas Medicaid and the Arkansas Department of Human Services. Dr. Golden?
Thank you. And thank you, everybody, for spending part of your Thursday with us. Going to give you a bit of background about our journey in alternative-based payments over the last several years, of which maternal and infant care is one piece of a bigger picture. Next slide. A little bit about Arkansas Medicaid and the Arkansas healthcare system. We do not have managed care. We're putting our toe in the water with provider-led managed care for behavioral health in the very near future. So we have basically a very large integrated data set. All patients are assigned to a PCP, so there's direct attribution. And prior to the Affordable Care Act, we paid for about 65-67% of pregnancies. Now that we expanded Medicaid and did it with the private option, and patients can purchase health insurance with a Medicaid support, a large number of people who previously became eligible for Medicaid by becoming pregnant are covered prior to becoming pregnant. So our current direct coverage of pregnancies has gone from about two-thirds to about one-third over that period of time. We also cover a huge chunk of pediatric costs, and we still do, so we have a lot of interest in the care of well children, mental health of children, and chronic children with chronic disease and disabilities. Next slide. So we have been very interested in using our data to improve our health statistics and our health system performance. For many years, like Louisiana, many southern states, we lagged many other parts of the country on performance measures. And so we have been using our data sets and our potential for financial leverage to try to improve care and make care more effective and efficient. Especially later in the last 7 or 8 years, we wanted to come up with ways to reward outcomes, effectiveness, and quality, because internationally, everyone has the same problem. There is more demand for resources than we have resources. There are more services we can provide. So we want to make sure that we use our resources appropriately, and we incentivize all providers to be engaged stakeholders. So it's going to take providers, payers, patients, and policymakers to manage the system so that we do not have to go through the painful process of trying to either raise taxes, premiums, co-pays, or limit access, because neither of those four items have a lot of appeal, especially as financial pressures grow. Next slide. So we've gone through a couple of stages, and I'll go over with you some of these activities. Back in 2008 or so, we developed a pay-for-performance program, which I will give you some details about. That's in many ways a level two or stage two alternative payment mechanism. And we focused on things like early elective delivery, breastfeeding, timely submission of newborn screens to health departments, that kind of thing. We then evolved to episodes of care. 2012 to present, we were a precursor to what to CMMI's initiative. We were one of the first states to receive a CMMI implementation grant, and our activities were actually central to the development of the RFP for episodes of care that were offered and bundles of payment by CMMI. And I will describe the pregnancy episode a little bit. And then we've developed patient-centered medical homes, a large successful initiative that deals with a lot of well children, chronic disease in kids, a major effort to try to improve things like immunizations and well child visits. Next slide. So let's talk about, so one of the things that we did was that we, on the episodes of KLO, let me go back one slide. I've lost track of my direction here for a second. So I want to describe to you for a second the pay-for-performance program. What we did there was that we had a raise in the per diem rates for hospital services, and it was designed to withhold 5% of the per diem. That was put into a large pool, and then we developed a series of a basket of measures that the hospitals would have to pass in order to qualify for a 5% bonus on their entire book of business. So hospitals that were successful got six-figure checks very often, depending on the size of the hospital. So this was a voluntary program, though on the maternal and child materials, that was mandatory. If you were delivering babies, you had to participate in the maternal measures in order to be qualified for the bonuses. Otherwise, you had to select a bonus metrics, and you either had to reach the 75th percentile of the previous year's state average, or you had to have a substantial reduction in your previous year's failure rate to qualify for that measure, and you had to pass several measures. We then went on to the episodes of care, which you see there, which included all medical services pre and post an episode of care. So in hip surgery, for example, it would be pre-op and post-op care. In pregnancy, it was the entire pregnancy and a period of time after the pregnancy, and we captured maternal costs. We tried to develop something for neonatal ICU costs. That proved very complex, but gave us tremendous data analytics that helped us then design a utilization of you in a targeted way to improve our purchasing of neonatal ICU services. And the medical home I will describe in a little bit. Next slide. So on the episodes of care, that was kind of the framework you see there. And this has been adopted by Tennessee and Ohio. You may have seen this slide in other state presentations. But if you were in the, each of those vertical bars is the risk-adjusted average cost for an episode. So in this case, the average risk-adjusted cost of a pregnancy, provided that you took care of the baby or the mom for at least the last 8 weeks of the pregnancy, when we covered all costs involved with the pregnancy. If you were in the dark green zone or the lighter green zone, you got 50% of the shared savings between the commendable and the gain sharing limit. If you were in the gray zone between acceptable and commendable, you got your fee for service, but no other money. And if you were in the pink zone there, above acceptable, you owed us 50% of the cost above the acceptable line. So this was sort of a level three plus, heading toward four, kind of an alternative payment mechanism. Next slide. To make sure people knew what they were doing, we launched this in 2012, so this was quite a while back. And we have a portal, and this was a multi-payer effort. So the private payers were involved as well as us. So were the qualified health plans. So everybody, at the beginning of the episode in 2012, all providers got their previous year's data that included their average cost per case, where they stood and compared to peers, how their costs broke down, whether they were consuming extra ER visits, radiology, pathology, laboratory. They knew exactly where their patient journeys spent money, and they were able to get updates on their performance portfolio quarterly with about a six-month lag in their data. And this was all put on a common portal that all the major payers shared so it was one-stop shopping for all the providers. We had coaches out in the field to get people to be able to access the portal and know where to find their data. That was the mechanism for perinatal care. Next slide. The medical home program, we gave PMPMs and shared savings dollars. Again, if you reached certain thresholds on your per member per year cost, primary care got 50% of their savings below that threshold. But we also paid PMPMs as an investment, and we required things like 24/7 access to care, i.e. moms can call people at night and on weekends and not get an answering machine. We have gotten rid of answering machines in Arkansas. We had people identify high-risk cases, develop care plans for high-risk patients, a variety of structural improvements in their medical home environment, as well as then to qualify for shared savings, they had to reach certain quality thresholds like child visit rates, and eventually want to use immunization rates when we have better and more reliable immunization data from our public health registries for immunization data. Next slide. To accomplish all of this, it's been a long journey. We've had, it's really taken a village of outreach and data analysis and stakeholder engagement. So we've had the governor's office prepare the vision. We've had our department host meetings, develop the framework, data mine our data as well as our multi-payer data, which was mined by the payers. The legislature had to approve regulations and our playbook, if you will. We have contractors, we have outreach teams, we have a lot of big data management. Same thing was true for private insurers. The clinical leaders, they liked the fact that it wasn't managed care, so they gave us cautious acceptance of these new models. And then we had ongoing town halls as the models were rolled out to get feedback from clinical leaders and then take their feedback, rearrange the requirements, and then re-present the material to folks, both pre-initiation and during the implementation phase itself. Next slide. This obviously required a lot of data. We have Blue Cross have their own robust data warehouse. We've now shown how we can document and create reports on practice variation and then tie that to financial incentives. We use national homegrown measures. In the P4P program with hospitals, they report the data, but we then go out and validate their submissions to make sure that they qualify for bonuses. And as I just said, we have all sorts of data reports to our provider community, and the more data we give them, the more data they want. Next slide. That's a lot of data. Just Medicaid alone, we've processed over the last several years 2 billion claims, millions of episodes, large numbers of reports. It's really big data, we can make it better if we can harness data out of clinical electronic medical records. This is all administrative data, and we'd love to integrate electronic medical record data into this kind of framework. Next slide. Here's some results. Top slide up on top there. Since we did the early elective delivery, pay for performance starting in 2011-2012, you can see, actually go in the bottom left corner, the first year we paid for reporting 70% of non-spontaneous deliveries before 39 weeks, between 37 and 39 weeks were elective. Scared the heck out of everybody. The providers woke up, and we then began to ratchet down the framework that you would qualify for bonus. And over a couple of cycles, we have eliminated 95 to 99% of early elective deliveries by merely data reporting and financial incentives on a single metric. And you can see in the top slide, births after 39 weeks went from 55% to 64% over the next period of time. Deliveries between 37 and 39 weeks went from 34% down to 26%, and it stayed there. And real prematurity has stayed at 9.8%. This results in 3,000 fewer deliveries every year in our state before 39 weeks. That's quite an accomplishment, we think, in a very short period of time. We went on to that, the breastfeeding at discharge, we went from one of the lowest states in the country at 25% for Medicaid recipients to 33% over time, a much tougher lift, but that's an increase of about 30% with the pay-for-performance program. And we have tackled low-risk C-section, so if you get rid of the initial C-section, you don't get the second C-section. And we've gone from 28% to 23%. We are now below the Healthy People 2020 goal by this pay-for-performance program. Next slide. So things that we've learned. Well, analytics are essential, but it's a very demanding garden. There are lots of gremlins as you do this, and you have to be very careful with your data. People love to have real-time data, but we don't have that. We only have claims data. That's why we want to get our hands on electronic medical record data. We are giving people the patient journey, not just what's in their system. So people get data not just from their hospital, not just from their practice, but from wherever the patient gets care. That's extremely valuable. But you can miss data. People get services they don't get paid for. Patients move. All sorts of very problematic things you have to be on guard for. People gaming the metrics. We have to watch for that as well. How do you know when you get there? Well, you have concept, outreach, you do implementation, but until you actually pay out bonus money or take back money, you don't know how good your data are, because once you start putting money on the table, people start pointing out flaws in your data. So that's the big warning to everybody. Until you payments are finalized, you're only in transit in your program. And we have problems that national payers, self-insured payers, often don't want to play. And this is, we've had Walmart involved, but it's been very hard to get others involved. They want a free ride and don't want to invest in these kind of alternative payment mechanisms with bonus incentive money. Next slide. Some of the challenges we've had, well, we have a very low payment system, so we've reached a ceiling on what we can get away with in terms of achieving incentives for episodes, whereas the private payers have much more variation in their cost structure. Their impact on perinatal care has been quite substantial. I think it's recently been published by Mike Chernow at Harvard, and there's been a substantial reduction in some of their costs on a perinatal episode. Our C-section rate for Medicaid has gone from about 37% to 32%, and our length of stay for pregnancies has gone down about a half a day. Electronic medical records is very much a limitation area. We'd like to have it better. And we are now developing practice snapshots for people to help people guide decisions as to who they make referrals to and how they manage their medical neighborhoods. Next slide. So key thing in designing VPMs, the whole thing is patient journeys, niche populations, social determinants of health. The future of metrics really is about stewardship and rewarding total cost of care, patient satisfaction, managing the medical neighborhood. So you really need financial incentives and timely and valid data to give to the stakeholders. So that's the end of my presentation. Thank you for listening.
Thank you so much, Dr. Golden. We have a few questions for you, and then we will open it up to all of the presenters to answer questions. The first question is, how does VBP work for low-risk cesarean deliveries? How would you discern whether the C-sections are appropriately medically indicated?
Yeah, we're using the Joint Commission National Metric. They have used that now for their accreditation program. We have given the hospitals that as their playbook. And then we go in later and validate to make sure they've collected the data appropriately. We do a random selection on those cases that we identify through our claims data.
All right. The next question is, what are the barriers to integrating electronic health records?
The electronic health records, many of them cannot extract data. We have done surveys. We've given our data to ONC and CMMI and CMS. We've on their speed dial. We've asked them to demonstrate, can they pull diabetes data? A lot of them thought they couldn't. They can't pull it at a practice level. They can pull it at a provider level. There's been a tremendous lag in the capacity of many electronic medical record vendors to really provide the capacity to do quality metric extraction. It is a technical issue, not a provider. It's not the lack of interest or willingness of the providers. It's very often a technical problem that's in the software level at this point in time.
All right, and then the last question for you, Dr. Golden, right now. Does your portal include information on the total cost of their members' care, including costs outside of the pregnancy, like pharmacy utilization, behavioral health care, or emergency utilization that may not have been associated with the pregnancy?
Yeah, that's correct. We do look through the, we do total cost of care. We do certain exclusions. We do exclude certain very high-risk cases like cystic fibrosis patients and that kind of thing. We try to prune away certain expenses that were not pregnancy related, but they see everything that the patient experiences, and they get a total cost snapshot, both from their practice and where the patient wanders off to, including ER and so forth. So we do include most expenses with a few exclusions.
All right, thanks, Dr. Golden. So now I have a couple questions for Dr. Mehta from Louisiana. The first question is, how do you supply data to your EQR for their evaluation of performance?
That's a great question. So the performance improvement project protocol is defined loosely in the contract with CMS, and we try not to enter into that too much as the fee-for-service Medicaid. So the MCOs are self-reporting outcome measures and process measures to the external quality review organization in the form of reports that the EQRO then responds to with queries, and there's this back and forth conversation. We are present in that conversation, but we are trying not to sort of dominate the improvement process, and with the EQRO kind of brokering the improvement journey for each MCO. So that is all self-reported by the MCO. What we then are able to do is provide any aggregate figures to the EQRO from fee-for-service claims so that there's a way of, to some degree, validating the quality of the data that's coming out of the MCO, or at least to generate questions about where discrepancies in those two sets of claims may be coming from. Hello?
Sorry about that. One more question for you. It appears from the graph that the preterm birth rate in Louisiana actually increased despite the recent increase in 17P delivery. Is that correct?
So it does, there was a slight increase, and that's a great point. And I want to point out that the source of the two sets of data that we showed were two different sources. So the total preterm birth rate, as you saw it on that slide, is being calculated from our vital records in our Office of Public Health. So we use a set of checkboxes on birth certificates to look at gestational age. And the data coming out of Medicaid claims focused on progesterone initiation is obviously claims data. What we haven't been able to do yet, which is a current effort of ours, is to do an analysis similar to what came out of Ohio and the improvement work in Ohio, where we actually look at changes in the preterm birth rate over time, focusing on the group of preterm births that we expect to see going down as a result of progesterone. So progesterone has only been shown to work in pregnancies where there was a prior spontaneous preterm birth, and it differentially has a higher impact depending on the gestational age of the prior birth. And so in order to really see if our uptake of progesterone is directly impacting our prevalence of preterm birth, we would need to do a more stratified analysis, which isn't reflected in the data that we looked at here. you are completely correct about that. And since I have the floor, I just wanted to share, I think it was Helen's question about the denominators. So we're looking at about a denominator of about 3,200 births in 2016. And that number has been pretty consistent over time, ranging between 3,100 and 3,200 births a year. And just to reiterate what that denominator actually is, that's women who had a prior singleton preterm birth, women who had were pregnant in 2016 who had a previous preterm singleton birth between 24 and 36 weeks and who met a continuous enrollment criteria in Medicaid from week 16 of pregnancy through the date of delivery.
Thank you so much. So now I have a question for all of the presenters. And the question is there a role for state health information exchanges in the data querying? And anyone can answer this question.
The answer is absolutely yes, but we have to get the, it's all part of building their capacity. We're in close contact with David Kendrick in Oklahoma that has one of the better systems in the country in that regard. But the issues I had talked about earlier about data extraction from electronic medical records remains a problem all over the country. So yeah, the holy grail is to actually develop this so that this kind of health information exchange can feed into these value-based purchasing activities, let people identify, get feedback about the care gaps, because the care gaps can be filled in sites more than just an individual provider, but at the same time help guide and the provider community in developing value-based care and also help the payers understand how the system is performing. But it's going to take a few more years.
All right, thank you for
that. I would just completely agree with that. And I think that our high-risk pregnancy registry reflects that there's a certain level of stratification of risk and then determination of adequacy of response that we can only get at if there's partnership between different entities in order to validate different data sources and also establish a longitudinal system to identify those who would benefit most from a particular intervention. And I absolutely agree that it's about capacity building and the amount of capacity building that had to happen to create that registry, even just that's tailored towards the identification of one population for one quality measure, was enormous. So I think thinking about how to create larger collaborations so we don't have to reinvent that wheel every time we want to focus on a new target is really, really important.
And I will say in Arkansas, it's a multi-payer effort. The private payers in our state, realize that we can't build an HIE off of user fees. Increasingly, the payers are looking to actually help fund the HIE to take the financial burden off of the doctors and hospitals because they often get dinged not by just by the HIE, but also by the vendors. And we hope to avoid those financial burdens and create a robust system that's more of a public utility that meets everybody's needs.
All right. Thank you so much for both of our speakers, and thank you to our audience for asking those questions. So in terms of our key presentation takeaways, we've heard that there is really a need for payment reform within the maternal and infant health field, and there's also an opportunity for state Medicaid agencies to improve health outcomes by considering the use of value-based payment. And as we've heard from our state presenters, those design elements that Dr. Mark Smith discussed earlier, such as financial incentives and performance measures, are key. It's also important to get buy-in from stakeholders first, share best practices whenever available, ensure that measurement tools are timely and accurate, utilize financial incentives, start small and build up to scale, sustain political action, and finally, take accountability for the patient journey. In conclusion, value-based payment stands to improve the quality of care, improve access to care, and reduce the cost of care. Next slide, please.
A resource list, which includes general information and information specific to maternal and infant health, is available for download in the widget. And I want to thank all of the audience members and our presenters again for participating in today's webinar. Please take a minute and complete the short feedback survey that will pop up on your screen at the end. Have a wonderful day, everyone.
This concludes the webcast for today. Please submit feedback to the presentation team using the survey in your browser window when the event concludes. If you are unable to provide your feedback at this time, you can view the on-demand recording of the event and access the survey widget there. The on-demand will be available approximately one day after today's webcast and can be accessed using the same audience link that was sent to you following registration. Any future topics or discussion points can also be shared with the team using the Medicaid IAP at cms.hhs.gov mailbox. Thank you.